What's good? We are back. Paul Masson live from Vietnam, and we finally got the technical issues figured out. So we decided to go ahead and just go live again. And I'm going to bring on a cat that came out around, I think, 95. Some of y'all might know him as Gemini the Gifted One, but he's changed his name to Big City, if I'm not mistaken. Let's bring him on, the one and only Gemini the Gifted One.
What's up, good, man? What's going on, brother?
So how you feeling tonight, man?
I'm better now that we got these technical difficulties. That shit was a headache, bro.
Yeah, I'm actually going to be switching to a different streaming software here soon, man. I've been not liking this one as much. I mean, it's got some pros and then some cons with it.
Right. Hey, let's make a correction real quick. I didn't change my name.
Oh, you didn't?
No, I just okay. Added. So I'm still Gemini the Gifted One.
Okay.
City, aka the Brooklyn Basquiat. I just added on. You know what I mean?
Okay. Just yeah, like Wikipedia said you changed the name and whatnot.
Nah, I just added on. It's no different than, you know, everybody is. You got Hov, you got Hova, you got Jay-Z, you got Jigga Man. Same shit. Notorious B.I.G., Biggie Smalls, Nas Escobar, Esco, Nasty Nas. Same shit.
So let's start with a basic question, like the name. How'd you come up with the name?
Which one? Gemini the Gifted One?
Yeah.
I was, it was in a song. Gemini was my name back when I was a young breakdancer, B-boy, popping and all that. That was my name, Gemini. And I was rapping back then too. And then I had a line much later when I was at the stage where I was trying to get on in the entertainment business. And I had a line in a song. Well, I referred to myself as the Gifted One, and then my man AB Money, some of y'all might know him. He's in a legendary rap group called Rapping is Fundamental, producer Easy Mo B, and AB Money said, yo, you should use that as your name. And I thought he was joking, and then he said it again. He was like, nah, you should really use it. So I said, all right, and I kept it in the stuff.
Now, your first deal was what, Mercury Polygram, right?
Polygram Mercury, that's right.
So what was the process back then of you trying to get that deal?
Well, it was crazy because I had been trying to get a deal for years, man. I was trying to get a deal back when I was a youngin', 14, 15 years old. I was running up to the with demo tapes trying to get a deal everywhere I could. And I remember one funny story. I forget what label, what's the EPMD was on. And I was running up there with me and my partner at the time, J. Cool, God bless. We were trying to get a deal, and they were coming out the building. I'm like, God damn, these niggas is tall. I didn't know they was that tall. That shit fucked my head up. I thought they was like my height. Went in there, that young lady who sang, come into my life, I got so much. She was the secretary. She was over working the corner. I think her name was Joyce Sun working in the corner. So I was back trying to get deals back then. But long story short, much later, 95 or 94, I'm in a rap group with a dude. We go up to Polygram Mercury, try to get a deal. We didn't get the deal. The following year, DJ Goldfinger, big up Goldfinger. I always got to big up Goldfinger because he is the man and the reason that I got a deal. DJ Goldfinger. I didn't say his praises enough throughout my career. I didn't even realize I wasn't doing it. But everybody out there who wants to really know what was that last stage of getting a deal, DJ Goldfinger had a group with my man Lunatic, Headstrong, and another artist. It was called Full Metal Jacket, and they were about to sign a deal there. I met them in the studio one night, didn't know Lunatic. I mean, I knew Lunatic, but I didn't know Goldfinger. I jumped on a freestyle on the B-side of the single they were shopping to Polygram Mercury.
Okay.
Looked at singular they were shopping, and they let the A&R hear the B-side, thank God. You know, shit just falls into place. And so the A&R said, who's that guy on the B-side? They said, that's Gemini. He said, Gemini from Brooklyn? He remembered me. He said, can you bring him up here? Goldfinger said, yeah. He brought me up there, and the rest is history. That's how I got my deal, just by happenstance, just like that.
Now, did they get a deal out of it too?
No, unfortunately, no.
Wow.
The budget closed after they signed me.
Yeah.
After it was myself, Ill and Out Scratch, Black Sheep. Black Sheep brought in a group that got signed on their production deal. I think it was Drez's production deal. He had a group called The Legion. And another group from Virginia called the Yagfu Front. They was like Artifacts or Soul.
Yeah, I interviewed them early this year. They're actually from North Carolina.
Who, Yagfu Front?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. North Carolina. We went down there to see them one time. And so all of us were over there, but no, Goldfinger's group wound up not getting the deal. And to be honest, that's one of the biggest regrets of my career, that his group didn't get a deal when I got that deal. I always go back because they deserved it. In fact, Lunatic from that group, his name is Headstrong. Uh-huh. They have a label called Red Rum, and we're actually getting ready to do a single. And this shit is fire too. And he and I are about to do a single that's coming out this year.
So you drop a 7-track EP, Scars right. and Pain, which right. was promo only. It was promo only, it says. Yes, who decided that? Who decided to do promo only?
Well, the label, the A&R, I don't think he was really in control of that. They was having some issues with the budgeting because at that label, Crystal Waters came out the year before I got there. And her record went gold. I think it was 100%, it was 100% Pure Love. It was la-da-dee-da-da-da. It's that record. So now I come, my shit is getting some traction. The single is getting some traction. But the program directors at the record company told the label, we're only going to spend one Polygram Mercury record. I guess they didn't. They wasn't putting that budget. But you know how shit was back then.
Yeah.
Putting that money over there. So I got word on the grapevine that the president of the label, Ed Eckstein, son of the great jazz legend, Billy Eckstein, for music lovers out there, told the A&Rs and everybody else, we're not putting any more money into his project. We're going to let it do what it do. If it make it, it make it. If it don't, it don't. And it was just beginning to get traction at that time. But 100% Pure Love had taken off. So yeah. In my record and that record, what Hot 97 was going to play and the other big shows. The Bob Beatles and the Stretches of the world, they were playing my shit. The Mixtape Cats of the world, they were playing my shit. But the label was like, we're not putting no more money into it. And it was funny because nobody told me. I just noticed there was no more movement with the project, which was so highly lauded and touted at the time, and then it just stopped. And then my A&R stopped picking up the phone. It got real nasty. So I went up there, and then somebody who I was cool with at the label, I won't say their name, pulled me to the side, and it was like, we're going to tell you what really happened. They told us not to put no more money into the project, and it's going to sink or swim on its own. So I decided I wasn't going to sign again. I was for the next... they called me and they were like, yo, you got to redo your contract. Da, da, da. I just egged them and was like, fuck that. You know what I mean? Y'all fucked that one up. Well, I'm going to go over here and do it again.
Now, your first single was Funk Soul Sensation, produced by Organize. Was that not your first?
Okay. It was Brooklyn Kids.
But, okay, with a joint Funk Soul Sensations, how do you get Organized Confusion producing it?
Okay. The A&R seemed to have a relationship with a lot of producers who were trying to get on at that time or who had just got on, were early stages of getting on. So he knew some of those cats, and some of those cats knew other cats. And so I don't know how he had the relationship, but he had a relationship. I forget that other label. There was another label that they used to fuck around with. And but he had a relationship, and he brought Prince Poe up to the label. And Prince Poe played me some beats. He brought Minnesota up to the label.
Who I had for Money Boss Players?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just interviewed him like a couple months ago.
Did he tell you what his first placement was me?
I don't remember I knew that. I saw that.
I got him his first placement in the business. I'm proud of that. I'm saying it because I'm proud of that. I got Minnesota his first placement. And other producers too. I've got a couple producers who went on to greatness, I was instrumental in getting in the door. But Minnesota came with Beats. The A&R set that up. Buckwild, who I knew from high school, when the A&R brought him up, I was like, oh shit, this Ed from high school. What up, Ed? We like, peace each other. He threw me some beats. And I picked some beats from that. So Minnesota, and then Principal threw me some beats, and that's how you got the Funk Soul Sensation. So Funk Soul Sensation was the first commercial release because it had the video with it. So that's what everybody saw. The first time they saw me on Rap City and all of that kind of shit, it was from the Funk Soul Sensation record. But the single that came before that was, I guess, to lay the underground part of the marketing, and that was Brooklyn Kid. A lot of people said I should have did a video for that one first.
And you peaked at, what, number 36 in the Billboard's Hot Rap Songs chart. What was the feeling like around that time?
You mean when I saw that? Well, we had to go
Gavin
first. A lot of people don't know about the Gavin. Billboard had a subsidiary, smaller magazine chart called the Gavin. And you had to get to the top 10, 20 in the Gavin to be able to get to Billboard. And so so good just to get in that top 20 spot, top 10 spot in Gavin.
Yeah.
You know, that flew me out to San Francisco to the Gavin headquarters to interview with them and all of that. And then to get over there to the other side, to the Billboard side, I was just, I was proud to say the least. You know what I mean? It had been a long journey. You know, I'm a dude that started trying to get record deals at 14, you know, and I'm a dude who been rapping since 11, 12, you know, and I say rapping, not in the house. I'm outside at the jams with the big boys, tearing their asses up in East New York.
Now, how did you and Danger Mouse end up working together, man?
Okay, we fast forward it. Let's go. I was working with a producer named Dubell, right? That's my cool white boy homie. Producer Dubell. And I was also in that camp. Dubell was building his own little camp at a small place called Gray Boss Studios on 16th Street, Lexington Avenue in Manhattan. Big up Larry Federer, I think his last name was. I forget his last name. He passed away. But he used to collect vinyl. He sold vinyl all over the world. So he let Young Boy in there, which was Dubell, Mike Delaney. And another artist brought me up there. What is my man's name? It'll come to me. I'm having a brain fart right now. But another artist I know brought me up there. I started recording with him. And we put out a single while I was over there, too. We started a little label over there. And then we put out a single. Danger Mouse, who had been a fan of all my other years of work, hit us from London. He emailed. And I came in one day. They were like, yo, some guy from London wants to get with you. And that was the beginning of that.
Yeah, because he actually has one of my favorite songs of all time, that Two Against One.
Who, Danger Mouse? Or
yeah, Dubell? I think he produced it, if I'm not mistaken. The Two Against One.
I'm not sure.
I don't know if you heard it.
Nah.
Now, I was seeing where it was saying you were one of the first guys to, like, rap and sing. Is that true?
Well, it's true and not true. In the days that preceded me, you know, Rakim is my predecessor.
Okay.
Came before me, but before them was the Fearless Four and the Treacherous Threes of the world and all that. So those guys, before the Rakim era, had a style that I call vocalizing, because it's not really, you're really talking in a melody. So you're like, rock, profile, groove, a gasta, great class, never name, and a vicious profile, bebop, you're doing stuff like that.
Yeah, now, yeah.
The whole group is doing that. It's on one note, and you're not really singing, but it's melodizing, so that's what And as a matter of fact, on that Scars and Pain record, I did an ode to that. It's a song called Tribute that I did, which is an ode to that era. So those guys were, if you will, singing before me, right?
Yeah.
I think I was the first one to actually be able to truly sing. I think I was the first, male. Not female, because Angie B could sing. That's Angie Stone. They called her Angie B way back in the days when she was in a group Sequence. So she could sing. They could sing. But for males, I don't really know of any other males. There might have been, but I don't know of any other males who were like hardcore true MCs who could actually sing. But I sang in the church.
I only know one other one that kind of, I don't know if he could sing as good as you, but like DV Alias Christ kind of.
Christ was a, was another vocalizer or melodizer.
Yeah.
He like, I love Christ, but that's not safe.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's what I said, kind of, yeah.
In that category with vocalizing or melodizing, I put it in that category. And I love Christ. I'm a big Christ fan.
Yeah.
That whole camp, Smooth the Hustler.
Yeah.
I had the pleasure to be on the stage with them one time in Harlem, but with Trinity Gallery. But those guys didn't sing.
Yeah.
Even somebody that I love, Mos Def.
Yeah, I can see that. I see what you're talking about. Yeah.
Singer. It's not a true singer. Like, this is just my opinion. This is the way I see it. This is where I learned it. If you can get up in the church in front of with the choir, in front of the crowd with the organs playing and all that, and truly sing, that's singing.
Yeah.
Okay? Just because you can take your voice and do something that sounds nice and melodic and works, that's cool. And I love the records. But that's not singing to me. So I think I was one of the first guys, male, who could actually sing. But the problem was, at that time, which is what we call the golden era of hip hop now, the label didn't know what to do with a hardcore.
Do with that, yeah.
They hadn't. They used to tell me shit like, because I used to get, well, not used to, I still get fresh. I get fresh. I'm from Brooklyn, we get fresh. They weren't used to that.
Yeah. So,
like, how Biggie was dressing when Diddy took him and restyled him? Because if you remember Biggie from when he was with Supercat,
yeah,
with the bandana on his head and the jersey,
yeah,
that was the original Biggie. And then Diddy came in and restyled him and created.
Had him wearing suits and all types of stuff.
The raw silks and all of that. But I was dressing like that anyway, without a record deal. That was just how I dressed. So when I got up there. You know, I remember them telling me things like, yo, you don't have to, you know, dress so coordinated all the time. And you don't have to speak. I remember that. This stuck in my head one time they came. It's like, you don't have to speak so well. You know, you speak very well. You know, it dawned on me that label, and probably within the industry is probably the same thing. They didn't know what to do with a dude that was polished and raw. Like, to them, to be a hardcore MC, it appeared to me that they had some type of image that was supposed to be. You know, but I was more than that, and I wanted to show that I was more than that. So I'll do a 50 MCs in a cypher, but then I'll do a story of my life. Because I wanted to show that I'm more than just that. And I don't think they were ready for that. I don't think they knew what to do with it. Ironically, we did a promo tour, and I was with the Fugees. And I'm a Gemini, May 27th. Lauryn Hill is a Gemini, May 26th. And she came backstage. She's like, I want to meet this guy Gemini. Where he at? And I was like, oh shit! Everybody get out. So she came through, and I'm a big fan of hers. And this is when she was in the Fugees, first album. And we got to talking, and she said, what she really wanted to sing. And she told me who some of her favorite singers were, and I told her the same thing. I was like, I really want to sing too. I told her.
Yeah.
My favorite male singers, and we had that conversation, and I never forgot that because that's what she did when she got the chance. You know,
Didn't sing on none of the first album, did she?
Fool la la la.
Oh, that was her on the hook. Yeah, that was about it, though, right?
I think that was about it.
Yeah. On the first one. As soon as she started singing, that's when she really, really took off too, man. That's when people just realized she was just more than an MC.
Because they knew what to do with
it. Yeah.
Latifah used to sing too. But when I was speaking about the males, Latifah used to sing too. But for males, I didn't know. I mean, you could tell me, but I don't know of any true hardcore, true upper level MCs who could really sing. I don't know of any. And that label didn't know what to do, like Lauryn Hill's label knew what to do with her. My label didn't know what to do with me. And so so we missed that boat.
How do you feel about all these rappers nowadays kind of like trying to vocalize everything with the rhymes?
No, the song is dope. It's dope. Yeah. I was okay with it even back when EPMD was making songs like, what's that song? Whatever you want, whatever you need. Keep the hardcore. Is it something the hardcore? They were railing against people who were singing and putting R&B.
Crossover?
No. They had like a Roger Troutman singing hook in the song.
I think that was Crossover. Let's get up, let's get down, roll with the hardcore funk, the hardcore sound.
Crossover. That was keep the crossover. Yeah. But I didn't agree with that then. You know what I mean? I disagree with it then. And I always disagree with it because I remembered they used to sing in the early days of rap. You know what I mean? So I was like, how y'all saying keep the crossover with some of the hits from the early days of rap they were singing? I didn't understand that. And I think the early hip-hop audience of that era didn't remember or just didn't know that singing was always a part of hip-hop, if you could do it. Whether it was vocalizing, melodizing, or truly singing, like Angie Stone, like she was Angie B back then. It was always there, so I never understood the whole concept of keep the crossover. I never understood it.
So I thought something was very interesting. Yeah, the album Born Again that you had with Danger Mouse was officially recorded in like 2004, but y'all didn't release it till like 2023, which is actually like I guess the 20-year anniversary of y'all's original album. Yeah. Was that planned like that, or did just something prevent the album from coming out?
They were trying to rob me. The worst fucking label I ever been on. Worst recording. I'm saying it on the record. That's the worst recording experience I've ever had.
Yeah.
I fucked with a lot of labels and made a lot of records. And Lex Records was the worst experience I ever had. I will say they were all about Brian, Danger Mouse, which they should be.
Okay.
It wasn't about me at all. And I had problems with them from the very beginning. So that's why I never wanted them to. I got locked up after we did the first album. I got locked up. And I didn't want the masters to be turned over to the label. Mm-hmm. And they turned the masters over to the label anyway because he was trying to get out of his deal over there. So
he
had to give them a bunch of albums so he could get out of it. And he gave them mines, ours, he and I, even though he told me he wouldn't. But he did. And once they got it, they tried to strong on me for many years to just take the record and do whatever they wanted to. So I had to
go to
an attorney, and we fought them for many years because I didn't sign off on y'all releasing this album. And so they kept trying. Every couple of years, they would come back. Like every time Brian would win another Grammy, he's won like 8 so far. I think he's been nominated for 18. So big up. Because I saw his greatness back then.
Yeah.
He got everything he should get. But every time he would drop a new something that would hit, you know, like the Gnarls Barkley or the Nora Jones or something, they would come back to me and try to get me to sign off on them releasing the album for pennies.
Because they're trying to push it out while his name is hot at the time?
Every time his name was hot. Each time his name was hot, they tried to push it out again. So when A$AP Rocky and him did the album, they came back. When Black Thought and him did the album, they came back. When the Gnarls Barkley shit hit, they came back. They would always come back and try to get me to do it for pennies. And I was like, nah, it'll just sit there forever because I'm not giving you this. I knew it was a great piece of work.
Yeah.
I did. And Danger Mouse knew it too. But he wasn't as invested because he had blown up since then. So he wasn't really invested. It was like, that's just some other shit on the side. But for me, I was like, that's a great piece of art that I put my heart and soul in. So I wasn't about to just give it to him. So that's why it sat there for so long. They would come back, try to get it. A couple of times they tried to strong on me, like, we're going to release it anyway. What? And then my lawyer had to get involved, like, yeah, we're going to be in y'all asses if you do, because I signed off on this. But at least on 2 occasions, maybe 3, they definitely tried to strong on me. But they shitted on me with that album every way that you possibly can. They didn't put any video support, but in the contract they said they would. Danger Mouse was unwilling to do any promotion, but I knew that going in, so I couldn't be mad at him. But he wasn't doing any promotion. He wasn't going to do no shows. He wasn't going to do no interviews, anything. But the label didn't give it the support it needed. And when it came to the cover of the album, if anybody has, matter of fact, here's the album right here. And we'll talk about this later. But this is the album cover, right?
Okay.
This is not really the album cover. This is the cover. That's me on it. And people don't even know that I'm on this record.
Man.
The same thing they did with the first album where they fought me tooth and nail not to put my picture on the album. I never heard of no shit like this in my life.
Yeah.
Fought me tooth and nail not to have an image of me on the cover of my record. And they didn't want to do a video. I was like, what the fuck is this about? So when we got to this one, I was like, I got to be on the record. Got to have an image of me. So I went and hired an artist, great artist by the name of Andre Trenier. I'm an artist myself, so I drew out what I wanted, brought in Andre Trenier. He fixed it up. He did the actual graphic design and everything like that. Sent that to the label, and you know what they did?
What?
And the artist is dope that we got done. They brought in their own artist to redo the image that Andre
that he did
me. So they brought in a new artist to paint their version of my art. And then after they did that, they didn't want to put me on the cover because what I showed you of me was supposed to be the cover. They agreed, and then they put it on the back. And not only did they put it on the back, yes, I'm airing y'all out. Not only did they put it on the back, they made sure that any promotion you see from Lex Records for that record only shows the other side without me. And I've gone through things like this for my entire career. Like PolyGram never told anybody, hey, by the way, that's Gemini singing on this album. They never promoted the fact that that was me singing. So people to this day don't know that that's me singing on that record. When I got to Lex Records all those years later, Lex never promoted that that's me singing on the Ghetto Pop Life album. They never, it's nowhere written. Hey, by the way, Gemini's incredible vocals, blah, blah, blah. They never did it. And then they did the same thing with this album. People don't, those who have this album and anybody out there who got the album, thank you. I really appreciate you getting the album. But that's me singing all over that record. And only. Well,
it says you were supposed to drop a documentary for Ghetto Pop Life. Did that ever come out?
No, it wasn't for Ghetto Pop Life, but it is a documentary, and I'm currently.
It was entitled "Mice and Men."
It was originally "Mice and Men," and then we changed it to "Memoirs of an MC." And I'm currently shopping a deal for the docuseries and a deal for the TV series for that project. So that's the story. That's my story, which is inclusive of how I met Danger Mouse and how those albums came to be. That's because my story started a long time before Danger Mouse. I had hit records before that, you know, years before, quite a few.
I mean, I've been listening to a lot of your stuff lately, man. You had a really, really good sound, man. I mean, and everything, every song is different. None of them sound exactly the same, man,
That's the Gemini. That's the Gemini.
So what can you tell us about some of these new projects you're working on? I mean, you got a group called, I think, Adults Only, and then another group called OGs.
Okay, the OGs. This is my man, Mr. Bree, right here.
What's going on, man? What up?
Let the people see you, man. Let the people
see. What's going on? How you doing out there?
This is my man, Mr. Bree, right here. This man been with me over 20 years.
Okay.
He's been my hype man on stage for about 20 years, but he's been with me recording the studio since way before that, before I ever
had.
But he's been my hype man on the stage for at least 20 years. And so I decided that the next commercial release that I have is going to be a project with him, and our group is the OGs. And then after that, I'm going to release a project on him by himself, Mr. Green.
Okay.
So the single that I sent you is our single, Get Fly With Me.
Okay. Yeah. There's
another producer that I've been working with for many years. His name is Will Robeson. He's worked with everybody from Erykah Badu, Common, across the board. He, he's worked with a whole lot of people. And we did a project as soon as I came out of jail, and it was never released. So now we're back at it. We have a new single featuring Christopher Williams. That project is going to be called Keep the Faith. And the group is Adults Only, Gemini the Gifted One, Will Robeson, and the single is Keep the Faith featuring Christopher Williams, and the project is also called Keep the Faith. So both of those are coming out in this upcoming year. And then I have another project coming out called the Anthology, the Unreleased Music Anthology. I might release it as a mixtape, I'm not sure yet, but that's a full LP of music. A lot of things, man. I have another single coming out with Dub L. I have a single I recorded with Yazzie Divine. They call him Yazzilla. We have a single we recorded. I have a single coming out very soon with an artist by the name of Nondescript. Y'all can look him up on iTunes. We also call him Scripture or Script for short. And we got a banger called Devils and Deities. I sent it to you before we put it out. And we got a joint called Devils and Deities. It may be a part of the animated series called The Mighty Majestics. My attorney is also my business partner, and he has an animated series, books, comics, cartoon, film, whole platform for a series called The Mighty Majestics. And Devils and Deities will be one of the songs for that. So I just got a lot of music coming out this year. You know, my man Brown Bag Legend, got a song coming out with him called Up Again. It's hard to remember, but I got a lot of music coming out this year, a lot of music. Just trying to make sure everybody get their big up while I'm up here.
I want to ask you about like the Hip Hop 50th, like some of the celebrations and stuff. Like, what was your opinion on that? Do you feel like they represented hip hop right, or they left out a lot?
Different performances and different shows left out a lot, but they did a lot of different shows for the 50th anniversary around the country. And I think they kind of covered it with that. With the videos of those shows being aired all over social media, I think they kind of covered it with that. Some people feel like they missed out on quite a bit because the big shows didn't have all of the artists that they felt should have been in there. And, you know, what you gonna do? You can't get everybody.
Like,
I know who was pissed.
I know KRS-One wasn't too happy.
Willie D was pissed. Scarface went up there at that one show, and he did Ghetto Boys music, and Willie D wasn't there.
Okay.
I saw something online. They had a personal, they had a beef about that. But I don't think you can get everybody up there. You know, they probably could have got Willie D up on the stage with him.
Yeah.
But in most cases, you couldn't get everybody up there. But a lot of the different shows I saw had different groups of legendary artists. And I'm going to be honest. I went to one. Me and Mr. Bree went to one in Atlantic City. And I ain't going to lie. I was sitting there like a proud peacock, like knowing that I'm a thread in this quilt, you know, from the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, I was sitting there because a lot of these dudes is my mans. I'm up there looking at Blase. When we went in, my man Blase, we grew up in East New York. He was on the stage. I was like, that's my motherfucking, like, we grew up rhyming at the park, in the park together. So a lot of the artists that are up there, you know, some I knew, some I didn't know, some I knew one person removed. Like, I went to a school called Printing. And a lot of rappers went there. I think either Sticky Fingers or Fredro went there. The R&B singer Maxwell went there. Sean Price went there. This is all while I was there.
You know?
So when I see these guys doing what they do, I'm just like, you know, we broke through. But at that 50th anniversary, I saw artists that I didn't know T. La Rock was alive. I'm a T. La Rock fan. OCK. I'm a fan. So when I saw him up there, I felt good that this dude that from when I was a little kid, I idolized, that I saw him up on the stage doing. And let me tell y'all something. For y'all people out there that are watching, particularly, I would say some of the younger artists who are fans of some of us veteran MCs, you know, you got to understand, and this is something I didn't know when I was very young. When we gone, we gone. You ain't going to never get to see us do this song again. This song yeah. that you love, that you grew up when you were 8, 9, 10, 11, you were like, I love that song when I was a kid. When we gone, you'll never get to see us do that song again. You will hear it, but you won't get to see us doing our music. So you got to cherish it while you got the opportunity. That was something that I learned later as my icons began to pass. It dawned on me like a dummy, like, yo, I'm never going to be able to see that person sing that song that I love again. So I cherish it. You know, in New York, where were you located?
Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Carolina, okay. I don't know if y'all do this in the summer out there, but out here in New York, pardon me, I'm all stuffed up. In New York, we have a lot of summer festivals all over New York. So I'm in Brooklyn, some in Queens, some in Manhattan, some in the Bronx. And you get to see a lot of your favorite classic artists, hip-hop and R&B. And I try to make sure I attend because I get an opportunity to see people singing records that I've loved that my mother used to play and that I grew up going to the jams and we party to right now with the grown folks' parties.
Yeah.
To see them singing their songs. And that's a beautiful thing, you know. I've been seeing people post live performances of legendary artists that I thought was gone. James D. Train Williams, I saw him performing not too long ago. I was like, oh, shit. And these people have number one hits, y'all. These people have top 10 hits, y'all. These people have multiple. Let me tell y'all something. If you're listening out here, listen closely. It's hard to get a hit. I don't care how long you've been doing it. I don't care how nice you are. It is not promised to you to get a hit record. Period. Something that, and I'm. See, this is my line right here. It's called 100% Certified Classic Hip Hop because I represent a mindset that embodies this. Making a record that's going to be around 25 years from now, that people are going to show up and pay money to come see you perform because they love that song, that's a classic right there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not promised to you, all you dope new MCs. Oh, MCs are gone. Let's push that to the side. That's a whole conversation. That's a I'm the last. I'm in the last.
MCs are gone.
MCs. But for you rappers that are out there, it's not guaranteed that you're going to have a hit record. I'm talking about one hit record.
Yeah.
It's definitely not guaranteed that you're going to have a classic because every hit is not a classic. A classic 20 years from now, 30 years from now. People are still, and when that record come on, they're like, oh, that's my shit. And they'll pay to see that person. That's a classic. And not everybody's going to get a classic. So I'm blessed to at least have one. I have more than one, but I'm blessed to just have had one classic because it's a special thing. So when I get to see those cats before me, during me, make records, even the contemporary artists who are young, new, and making records right now, every now and then, you can make a contemporary classic. Not everybody can hear it, but you can make a record that came out yesterday. I can hear it and be like, oh, that's going to be a rap right there. That's a classic. Like Kendrick Lamar, he made some classic last album. You know what I mean? He made not just some dope records. He made some classics that are going to be around 25 years from right now. And that's what we strive for. True artists, that's what we strive for. We strive to try to make a classic record that people will, A, love now and love a long time.
Speaking of contemporary, I'm glad you brought that word up. There's a lot of rumbles out there where they're saying hip hop needs to have a contemporary subgenre. Do you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. I've always thought it. I think it's a farce, more than a mistake. I think it's an intentional, some bullshit. That's what I really want to say. That they don't separate it the way it needs to be separated.
Like classic rock. You got classic rock and stuff like that.
Right, you have hardcore rock, you have classic rock, you have rock,
punk rock, alternative rock.
Run DMC did hip hop rock, you know, when they got the cats and then Walk This Way and all of that. So, hip hop or rap music should have genres. It doesn't make sense that it doesn't have genres. It just makes sense that it should. It should have genres.
Yeah.
I don't mean genres like, oh, this is the old MCs and this is the new MCs. No, just What does your shit, what slot does it fit in?
Yeah.
Again, Bruno Mars did a record with Cardi B.
I didn't know that.
Used that, the style of the production was New Jack Swing.
Okay.
It was very similar to the open of In Living Color. I forget the record, but I love the record. It's Cardi B and Bruno Mars. Now, because that record, sonically, musically, fits in the genre of New Jack Swing, we don't want to have a New Jack Swing category, but it should fit where it belongs, because that's not the same thing that Sean Price is going to do.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? What those cats are doing is not the same thing that, you know, there should be genres. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I tell you this. Let's think about it this way. We don't have genres when it comes to hip hop because we don't own the shows that these awards are being given at. If the top cats, and I'm gonna say it, I'm gonna put it out there. If the Jay-Z's of the world and the Diddy's before he got into all of this shit and the other major players, the Pharrell's of the world, these cats are big.
Yeah.
Those cats have the status and the connections to get with investors and television people and so on and so forth to put together an award show that has the cachet of an Oscars and an Emmys. No
yeah.
slight to the Soul Train Awards, no slight to the BET Awards. Thank God we got those. But there's no reason why we shouldn't have an award show for the most culturally impactful and significant music of the modern era.
Yeah.
This is the most culturally significant music of the modern era. It is the, I'm going to say something nobody has ever said. It's the only music that can seamlessly fuse with every other music. No one's ever said that. No one. Hip hop is
Yeah, it pretty much goes with everything. You like you said, you rock, you could do a pop, you could do a reggae.
It has been done.
EDM.
Hip hoppers have been done, right?
Yeah.
Jamaican with hip hop. Hip hop was the music that came along that say you wanted to take, I'll give you an example. You take Third World. They did Now That We Found Love. That was an R&B song with a reggae feel to it, right? Well, hip hop was the only music that you could take this one art form and you could seamlessly fuse it with every other musical art form. It's never happened before in the history of the world. Never. And so for that reason, it needs to be handled a certain way, but it's not been handled that way because those of us who are in the position to make that happen haven't done it. It can't happen from the bottom up. I don't care how many people at the bottom. We start a movement. Hip hop matters. You know, classic hip hop matters. It won't mean shit unless we get pulled from the top saying this has to happen and pulling in their other great big multi-billion-dollar corporation investors to make hip hop have the same type of cachet that the major awards have. And that's the only way we're going to get it, get the categories the way they, like when, you remember when hip hop was heavy with jazz, like when when Q-Tip and them first came out.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a movement, you know, hip hop.
And Whatchamacallit I thought was kind of jazzy, cool like that. I'm hot like that.
Absolutely. They took the baton.
Yeah.
And then it was stopped after that, right?
Yeah.
So, but let's just say Tribe Called Quest, right?
Diggable Planets. That's what I was thinking of. Diggable Planets.
And that ilk of that sound. That was all jazz. That's a movement. Primo did a lot of jazz stuff, right?
Guru did the Jazzmatazz two albums.
Right? So why would a Jazzmatazz album be at an award show going up against a Public Enemy or some shit.
Yeah, yeah. I get what you're saying. Yeah.
It's at all. That makes no sense at all. So there was a time when hip hop was heavily influenced by funk. Remember that?
Yeah. Funk especially the West Coast sound.
The West Coast funk. They had a lot of Parliament Funkadelic, a lot of Bootsy Collins, a lot. We went through that phase. Then before that, we had a phase where it was heavy James Brown and the JBs and all. We were sampling that shit heavy. But if you put these records next to each other, they don't go up on the same award.
Yeah.
That's like saying Kenny G should go up against the Roots because they both playing some of this jazz feel. That doesn't, it just don't jive. It doesn't jive, you know? So you know, I think, yes, there needs to be categories for hip hop, proper categories, not age-based, just genre-based.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen, and it's not happening because those who have the sway to make it happen don't have the appear to have the desire, unless their hands are tied, and that's some other shit that we won't get into the conspiracy shit. But unless their hands are tied and they can't do it because of their own benefit of what they're doing. But that goes forward though. This is for like we should have our own Academy Awards. We should have our own Grammys. I love the Soul Train Awards and the BET Awards, but they're not held to the standard or the cachet of the Grammys. Because the same artist that you see at the BET Awards look like he dressed to go to the party, and then you see him at the Grammys or the American Music Awards, he's dressed to the nines.
Yeah. Or she,
you see that they themselves see it differently.
There's levels to this shit.
But we should have that. We should definitely have that. Pardon me for my rant.
Now you good. Do you ever be weighing in on like things like where Lord Jamar be the Puerto Ricans in hip hop and or like breakdancing isn't part of hip hop?
I never weigh in, but I listen. I heard I stayed out of that Fat Joe shit. I don't get in a lot of that shit, but I hear it. I have my own views about it. Hip hop. I mean, breakdancing is of course one of the four pillars of hip hop. That's ridiculous. Whoever said it wasn't.
Lord Jamar said that.
Yeah, it absolutely is one of the four pillars of hip hop. Because hip hop is not just music. Hip hop is a culture, and music is just one part of the culture. Turntablism is a real thing. Rapping is a real thing. Breakdancing. Before breakdancing, there was a thing called up rock. It's never mentioned. It was the moves that happen before you go down to the floor. And as a little kid, now watch this. I grew up in East New York, Brooklyn. Me and Mr. Bree grew up in East New York, Brooklyn. East New York is in the building, right? And there were Puerto Ricans on my block, my friends, their older brothers. So we're young. We're 9, 10, and 11. Their brothers are 14, 15, and 16. And I used to watch them because they used to do a lot of jams on my block. And I used to watch them doing the up rock, which is all of the moves that you do up, standing up before you go to the floor and start actually to break it. But that part of that component of breakdancing is never really talked about, that even existed. But I remember it clearly. But yeah, breakdancing is an electric boogie / popping is absolutely one of the four corners. And I would have to agree that from my personal experience and from my knowledge, Latinos were always there, but not in the numbers, not in the significant numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not in significant numbers. So if you had a crew, I had uncles who used to rap when I was a little boy. I see them rapping in the park. And big DJ crews like the Disco Twins from Astoria Projects were out there playing. My uncles are rapping. And you might see one Puerto Rican guy, you know, maybe even two. But that's not they're a part of the culture, but they're not the basis of the culture. You know, and I think that's just a fact. I don't mean no disrespect. They are a part of the culture. Some of them were there at the outset, but not in any significant numbers where you can say it wouldn't have happened because of them. That's just not true, to my knowledge.
Do you feel like, though, this might have been a topic to, like if Lord Jamar, like it's thing with Lord Jamar calling out KRS-One, I feel like this is one of them things okay, you feel what you feel, but maybe you should have just kept it to yourself because it seems very divisive right now at this point.
It is divisive. That's why I don't really fuck with it. But what did he say about KRS-One? Because I didn't watch the whole
thing. Well, KRS-One, I guess, was saying something about Puerto Ricans helped start hip-hop, and then Lord Jamar just like, no, they didn't. And that's where it really stemmed from because you got Crazy Legs wanting to box him. Crazy Legs literally want to box him right now over it.
Okay, so KRS-One is saying that Latinos or Puerto Ricans helped start hip hop, right?
Yeah.
That's what
they're
saying, right?
Yeah.
But hip hop is not rap music. Hip hop is the culture. And they did.
Yeah.
The first breakdancer I saw were not black, they were Puerto Rican.
Okay.
And the dudes I saw doing what was called in my neighborhood, East New York, was called the Up Rock. You remember Kingman and them, right? Mm-hmm. Kingman, they Little Richie, with the oldest, had a big brother named Eddie.
Right.
They had their little jackets with their names on the back, and they were all Puerto Rican. The breakdancers were all Puerto Rican, and the Up Rockers were Puerto Rican, the first that I saw. So, Buster, see if you can see this in your head. You got a bunch of rappers when rap starts, and you might have one, maybe two Latino rappers in there. Maybe two. You got a bunch of breakdancers, you might see one black breakdancer out of the crew. Maybe one, maybe two. A lot of breakdancers, but you might see one, maybe two. Now, when I say breakdancer, I'm differentiating. I'm not talking about Electric Boogie and the Pop. Because the black guys that I saw all did the Electric Boogie. All of them, including me as a child, including me. They did the Electric Boogie and they did the Pop. Although my Puerto Rican brethren, they did the Pop, they did the Electric Boogie, and they did the breakdancing. So you can never say that they wasn't a part of the early fabric of what became hip-hop.
Yeah. It sounds like what you're saying is they helped start a specific element of hip-hop.
Yes, they were instrumental.
Yeah.
They were instrumental. Yeah, that's a fact. But I'm from Brooklyn, so maybe I see it different. You know what I mean? And it is different in different places. You'll get a different perspective different places. But I'm from Brooklyn, and Brooklyn went everywhere. So you'll see Brooklyn people in Queens. You'll see Brooklyn people in the Bronx. You'll see Brooklyn people in Long Island. You'll see Brooklyn people in Staten Island. We was that borough. We went everywhere where everything was going on. Other boroughs, not so much.
Now, I listened to both of your snippets, man, you sent me. Keep the Faith, I felt like, had a really nostalgic and soulful sound to it. Get Fly sounded more like the clubby single and whatnot. It was still more hip hop than most of the modern day hip hop, which I thought was really good as well. You know what I'm saying? So was that really what you were going for on both of those songs?
Yeah, Get Fly with me. I wanted to do something that sounded like hip hop, right? Sounded like classic hip hop because I got songs that are trap and I got songs that are to drill beats as well. I don't differentiate. When the producer brings music, I'm like, that's hot. And I let the pen flow and sort it out. But on that one, I felt like, okay, this is classic hip hoppy and it's clubby. You know, it's up energy, up, you know, up vibe. So I hit the mark on that one. And then the other one is exactly what it was supposed to be. You know, my man, for that whole project, Keep the Faith, he wanted to do songs that were centered in that type of vibe. You know?
Yeah.
A little bit more spiritual conceptually, you know, with the adults only, with the group Adults Only, and this project, Keep the Faith, is more centered in that. Me and Mr. Bree over here, we going hard. We hip-hopping over here on this side.
Now, are you and Danger Mouse still cool though?
We relatively cool. Like if we saw each other, we'd be like, "Hey, what's up? What's going on this and the third?" But if I call him, he may not pick up the phone.
But yeah, it wasn't no like ill will or nothing. Like y'all just going y'all separate way or whatnot.
It wasn't ill will. It was just like, you know, he shitted on me. I mean, I can't say it no other way. He shitted on me. He gave the label the masters when he shouldn't have, when he said he
shouldn't have, yeah.
And I still got the letters from jail, just so don't try to check. All right, when you hear this,
he got receipts.
He wrote me back and said he wouldn't, but he did. So that was one thing. And then when I came home, I finally, you know, he had changed all his numbers, right? And I put you on. You know, I got you your first commercial release, but you changed all your numbers, so I can't reach you. And then, you know, we got to a point where when I finally did catch him in New York at a club, he didn't know I was coming. He was in New York with CeeLo. Me and my mans ran up on him, but we didn't run down on him. We wanted to run down on your boy, but I just said, I want to catch up to him and talk to him. So we talk, and I tell him, look, I'm just trying to keep my career going. You in a place right now where you can set up, you know, meetings. You could get me another deal if you want to. And he didn't do anything towards doing that. You know, he set up a meeting for me with some people. I went over there. You know, it was obvious they wasn't interested. They was just doing it as a favor to his manager or to him. They literally started talking to other people sitting in the middle of the meeting. They got the door open. They talking to people passing by. They passed me off to another subsidiary. They were like, go downstairs and go talk to them. It was that type of bullshit. So after that happened, we didn't speak for quite a while. There was nothing to speak about. It was pretty obvious. On my side, it was pretty obvious. He ain't fucking with you. And then when we did start speaking, when it was time to start negotiating the deal for the Born Again album, everything was just like normal. You know, it was like nothing ever happened. You know, it was like nothing ever happened. We talked, we laughed, we joked. But, you know, after we put out the record, I've called him a couple of times. He'll pick up the phone. But that's the business, you know.
Do you feel like the album still aged well, even though it took, like, you had to go through this process where you had to drop it 20 years later? But it was almost like perfect timing, though, kind of, right?
Right now, because hip-hop has got, because of verses and things like that, not just verses, but what Cassidy is doing, this and the 50-year anniversary, all that culminating at the same time, opened up a platform for veteran MCs who still had it to be able to be commercially viable and get visibility and get respect. That's what we weren't getting. We weren't getting respect. And so these different platforms that I just mentioned kind of opened it up for that to happen. So yeah, you're right. It kind of came out at the right time. But notwithstanding that, in terms of hip hop, it's a classic album on in and of itself of its own merit. Those are quality records. There's bars on bars on bars in there. Concepts are not the norm, like the normal 1-2-3 type cookie cutter album put together. It's a classic album in and of itself. It just happens to have come out at this time, and like you said, just happened to drop at the right time. But if it wouldn't have dropped at this time, if it had dropped anywhere in any of those other years, it still is a record of the highest quality in terms of hip hop, because there's not a lot of great hip hop records, you know, pure hip hop records to come out. That's a pure hip hop record. In fact, the Ghetto Pop Life record, which was me and Danger Mouse's first record, I've said, and I continue to say, it's one of the greatest pure hip hop records that people have never heard. I've always said it in the documentary, I say it. And if you haven't heard it and you're a pure hip hop purist, which I'm not always, I'm not a B-boy, so don't get twisted. I'm not one of those dudes that if it ain't boom bap, I don't fuck with it. That is not me. But if you love, if you are a hip hop purist, not just boom, boom bap, because a hip hop purist can love Arrested Development or Tribe Called Quest or Redman if you're a hip hop purist. Not all of that is boom bap. So if you're a hip-hop purist, I believe sincerely that the Ghetto Pop Life LP is one of the greatest hip-hop LPs you've probably never heard.
Well, I'm definitely going to go try to listen to it from beginning to end. My number one album of all time in hip-hop is Mobb Deep Infamous. I don't feel like I can put any album over that.
Okay.
I think it's a flawless album from beginning to end. There's not a single song you would skip. You know, and it's just like, it's so rugged and raw, man. You know, and the sound at that time, man, was just,
Yeah, I love Bob. Bob took me off the Hot 97 chart. They used to do a thing where you had to win for 5 nights, and then you win the whatever 5 nights and shit at Hot 97. And I got to the fourth night with Funk Sauce.
And they took you out.
The fifth night, that first Mobb Deep record came out. I was listening. Ones. Yeah. I said, oh, I lost tonight. I lost tonight because I love the fucking record. But also, yeah. I also, let's be clear, I saw a shift taking place in hip-hop. And that shift didn't take place only because of the music. That took place because something greater was happening behind the music. The commercialization of the music, the powers that be with the industrial prison complex, they needed to fill that motherfucker up. And so program, and for those who don't know this, program.
Yeah, I've heard the labels own like a lot of the prisons, they say.
The label owners, yes.
Label owners, yeah. Own the prisons and whatnot.
A lot of other people that we know, popular names that we know, or have stopped in that system. But radio stations, the program directors, were being mandated not to play a certain type of music at one point.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And therefore, the labels, of course, are going to be swayed to, well, if they're not playing such and such kind of music, we ain't going to be signing such and such kind of artists. So you see, you see a Dos Effect go from being the hottest shit to can't get on the radio.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, because they were like literally everybody said they changed the game. Nobody had a style like them. Everybody was copying their style, and then all of a sudden, it was like they wasn't a priority no more.
I'm talking about a genre of music. Dos Effect was one of those groups that suffered in that genre of music. A lot of people weren't able to make the switch to what the people behind the curtain were switching the game to. And I want to make it clear out there for people who don't know this history that the music just didn't change on its own. It didn't just go, okay, the new Mobb Deep shit and the new gangster shit is hotter than the shit previous before.
Yeah.
It was a different genre, but the powers that be made sure that only that was going to get on the radio. Therefore, labels aren't going to sign this other stuff that's not getting on the radio. They're going to only sign that. And it changed the whole culture. It changed the whole inner city culture, not just the music. That's just a part of it. But it changed the whole inner city culture. So I love Mobb Deep. I'm the biggest Prodigy fan. I love Mobb Deep. But but at the same time, there were other groups that came out in that window, came out before that window, who couldn't get, like Common couldn't get on the radio no more. Dos Effect wasn't getting on the radio no more. You wasn't going to hear no more Leaders of the New School. Like there was a, when the rap changed, everything became, one of the things that I noticed was the concepts of the songs became the same thing. Even though I love a bunch of that music, it was street, street, and more street. It was bang, 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 we get it popping, thug life, gangster shit, and it became strictly that. Whereas just prior to that, you could get an album with somebody who had a bunch of different songs about a bunch of different things. And not only a bunch of different songs about a bunch of different things, a bunch of different styles of hip-hop songs about a bunch of different things. That went the way of the dinosaur.
And, you know, I interviewed Just Ice probably maybe a month ago, and he was, you know, I asked him, did he label himself as a gangster rapper coming up? And he said, no, he didn't. And he said the label's the one that put that label on him.
Absolutely.
And he just looked at himself as a rapper. And even when I interviewed RBL Posse, who, I mean, he literally had two of his group members get killed. He literally said the same thing. Like, nah, we just looked at ourselves as rappers. We didn't look at ourselves as gangster rappers, but they put this label on you, gangster rap.
Was at a time when he could rap about whatever he wants. LaToya wasn't a gangster rap song. Let's go figure. Let's really look at it. So he was one of the first people called a gangster rapper. But on that same album, he had a record about a girl called LaToya, which was not a gangster rap record. You see? So the industry, the people who were pulling the strings created this thing, this model, and people began to file into that corridor, and the industry became specifically that. But you know, that's you know, that's like Rakim. He had a song about he used James D. Train Williams' song, I'm Curious. And he was rhyming about being a girl on the subway on the way to work. That's that song. But in another song, he talked about something different. There was a time when that was okay. And it wasn't just, and I'm not, so you got subject matter. That's one thing. That's the subject matter. But the style of the music itself, you could have different songs about different things that were different types of music production. That was okay. At a certain point, that went away. So every song on this record gonna be about how many people can you kill, how gangster are you, how tough are you, and that became
the norm.
That became the norm. That became the
and
norm.
Literally right now, that's all you hear nowadays is literally just that same thing. You either selling drugs or you doing drugs, that's or you gang banging.
MC is
going. Yeah.
The MCing was an art form. Rapping is not the same level of the art form, okay? An MC raps, but an MC is at the highest level of the art form. Let's let it be said. A Myself, a Mos Def, a Pharoah March, we're MCs. Yeah. And we can talk about the same shit the rapper talks about, but we take pride in the delivery of how we do it. How creative can we be with this pen and with this delivery on the same subject matter that the other person is using the same four-bar structure? Blah, 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 rhyme. Blah, 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 rhyme. Blah, 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 rhyme. Blah, 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 punchline. That's the normal rap structure.
Yeah.
It's 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. The rhymes are dropping on the 1. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. That's your regular, simple. And you can be dope at that, but that's not an MC necessarily. Some of those guys were, but most of them are not. It's two totally different animals. But my battery is about to die on this.
Yeah, we just hit over the hour mark. So before we go, man, any shout outs you want to do?
Yeah, I want to shout out Brooklyn, East New York. I want to shout out Mr. Bree over here. Look out for our new project, the OGs, our new single, Get Fly With Me. I want to shout out to Dose Only, producer Will Robeson. Let's see. Look out. I'm still shopping the deal, so let's hope the Most High bless the docuseries is Memoirs of an MC, and the TV series will be Memoirs of an MC as well. Big Ja, my partner at Stone City Digital Entertainment Group, which is my label. And I want y'all to check out my website, www.scdmetamedia.com. They're not there yet, but the Born Again album was re-released on vinyl. So okay. I have a small amount, a very limited autograph with my personal seal on it to add additional resale value, because you cannot put that on the resale market. There are no other copies of my vinyls and my work with my autograph on them or my seal. These are the only ones, and they're very limited. It is HHV re-released this on vinyl. That's Scars and Pain. But that is a double 12-inch with a 45 in there as well. My seal, okay, autograph, and number. Or if you want to get the original, a white label of the original Scars and Pain EP, there you go. We got a few of those too. Signed, numbered with my official seal. So they'll be on www.scdmetamedia.com. They're not there yet, but they will be in the next couple of weeks. So look out for that. We got the merch. This is 100% certified classic. Let me get up close so y'all can see it real good. All right? 100% certified classic hip hop. We got a merch line with that, so that'll be there as well. And look out for the new project. Stone City Digital is my label.
And I got your contact, man. I do music reviews on Saturdays, so I'm going to definitely stay in touch with you, man. You're probably like the 12th Brooklyn artist that I've interviewed this year. I've Smooth the Hustler, DB Alias Christ, Supreme the Elohim, UG from Cellar Dwellers, Illa G, and a few others, man. I mean, a lot of Brooklyn this year, man. I can tell you that much, man.
What's up? We here. Oh, matter of fact, I'm a partner in another docuseries. We're trying to get a deal for this one too. It's called Where Brooklyn At. It's produced by what's his last name? Damn. His brother is the dude from the TV show A Different World. Played Dwayne Wayne. I forget his name.
I was just watching White Man Can't Jump with him on it today.
Oh, you just checking that out?
Yeah, the original, yeah.
So the docuseries is called Where Brooklyn At. So you want to look for that. It's about it's a 6-part series. It's about Brooklyn's part in the advent of hip hop. That Brooklyn was always there. It wasn't just the Bronx and Cedric Avenue. That's not completely true. That's partially true.
Yeah, so, I would think that it would have traveled fast to other boroughs the way New York absolutely. Is.
It was always in other boroughs, you know. See, people have it in their head that it was there, and then it moved, and then it moved, and it moved. It was in other boroughs the whole time. You know what I mean? So there's actually a DJ documentary about that, too. But it's called Where Brooklyn At. So look out for that, too. And Memoirs of an MC, the docuseries, and the TV series. And that's what's up.
Well, I appreciate you taking time out. Sorry about the issues at first, man. I'm going to definitely get a lot of good clips, though. We got a good hour and 11 minutes in, so.
I hope you got some good shit in it.
Yeah, we got some good clips, man.
That's what's up. Yo, thank you for having me, bro. You know, long time coming. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely, man. And like I said, I'm going to keep in touch, man.
When I drop the new release, let's come on and do the full interview. Let's get the full hour.
Okay, I got you. You know,
when I get ready to drop the whole thing, I'll let you know.
All right, man. Y'all enjoy y'all's all right. night.
All right, you thank too, you, brother. Peace.
Salute. Right,
peace.
Carolina, salute.
Well, there you have it. Last interview of the year. Gemini, the Gifted One. Definitely go check out his music. Check out The Scars of Pain. He got a couple albums with Danger Mouse. Organized Confusion produced one of his early singles. If I'm not mistaken, he's on Prince Po's debut album as well. And he got the Keep the Faith single. You got the Get Fly single. You got the group OGs, Adults Only. And a lot of hip-hop discussion in there, man. A lot of hip-hop discussion. Appreciate y'all being patient with me. Sorry about the issues we had, but, you know, that's part of the podcast game, man. But before I go, definitely want to say rest in peace to my homeboy's friend again. I mean, his son, Samori Husamuddin, who was basically killed last night in that McDonald's in Santa Fe in Vietnam, North Carolina. Really messed up. They did catch the guy already. And we'll see how that goes. Hopefully that his family gets justice. If y'all pray, definitely pray for his family and have their best wishes in your heart. Definitely hits home for me, man, because, you know, I've known Venom probably. He knew me when I first started rapping, man. You know what I'm saying? Like 14, 15-year-old. Going to Spring Lake, doing music with my DJ. You know, he was coming around that time. And I met him, you know, around when I was probably like 14, 15, 16 area. I'm 45 now, so he's probably known me about 30 years of my life. Ended up moving into Bonnie Doon, where I moved right next to him years later. And he actually remembered me and whatnot, because he was a bit older than me. And we formed a rap group together called New Litter, The New Breed, which was me, him, and Lil Rico at first. And then Lil Rico got locked up for killing somebody and did a bid. And then Young Cakes took Rico's spot. And then it was me, Ali, and Young Cakes. And then after Cakes stepped out, then it was me, Ali, and his lady at the time, Black Widow, Queen Black Widow. And then we had a couple other people come in through the group. You know, you had Rommel. You had Michael Martin for a little while. couple other people that try to call themselves New Litter and kind of join the group in and out. But for the most part, it was really me and him. And, you know, I just think, I could only imagine what he's going through right now. I don't have no kids. Never been married. So I can only imagine what he's going through right now. It's got to be a tough time for him, man, to lose a child. It's got to be hard for any parent to have to bury their kid, man. So rest in peace to Samori Husamuddin. Only 25 years old, which is crazy, man. And OJ Mako, of course, he died too as well. They said self-inflicted gun wound. I guess he tried to commit suicide, which my pops committed suicide when I was 5 years old. So that hits home for me. And Greg Gumbel passed away as well. You know, three people in the last 24 hours that I heard of or I knew that pretty much passed away before the first of the year, which is really sad, man. Really, really sad, but really great interview, man. I'm glad Jim and I got it figured out. Glad we were able to do the interview. Definitely a long interview, about an hour long interview. And I'm going to get a lot of good clips. Appreciate y'all for tuning in. Peace, and I'm out.